we like to look at, just as a society and our sort of judgmental stance, we like to look at people who have money problems as being sort of outliers. Like, you know, what's wrong with these people? Well, the question really should be, what's wrong with the people that have somehow overcome this natural desire to spend as fast as you get it and consume as much as possible, which is kind of how we're wired as human beings. How can you overcome that to amass wealth and become wealthy? To me, that's the more curious question. I mean, the average American's in terrible financial shapes.
When we talk or think about money, the conversation is often focused on the actions we take. But have you ever taken the time to step back and think about what drives those actions? This week on the podcast, we're joined by Dr. Brad Klontz, a world-renowned financial psychologist and the co-founder of Your Mental Wealth and the Financial Psychology Institute. Dr. Klontz is going to dive into what role psychology factors play in your financial choices, what the four main unhealthy attitudes toward money are, and what we can do to give ourselves the best chance to overcome these attitudes and forge a better relationship with money. Making Your Money Work is a podcast focused on providing you with the information you need to live your best and most comfortable life. If you enjoy the show, make sure to subscribe, leave us a rating and a review, and let us know what we can do to help serve you better and what you want to hear in the upcoming episodes. On this episode of Making Your Money Work, I'm joined by a certified financial planner, a financial psychologist, the managing principal of Your Mental Wealth, an author, a contributing writer. I don't know if we've hit, I don't think we've hit all of them, but a lot more to go. Dr. Brad Klontz, we really appreciate you taking some time to sit down and chat with us here on this afternoon.
Very happy to be with you here, Isaac, talking about one of my favorite topics, obviously.
Well, and so we're not going to hold off jumping right into things. We'll start with kind of your background. Where did the financial aspect of psychology and kind of where did those two things mesh for you and how did you dive down this road?
Yes. So they are strange bedfellows. So I got out of grad school on a very personal, this is a very personal story. Got out of grad school. I owed $100,000 in student loan debt. And I was pretty freaked out about it. I was raised in a, you know, my mom likes to say we were middle class except lower. So I kind of came from that sort of environment where, and I was also taught though, you know, to be frugal, to try to not take on any debt. So it was sort of drilled into my head. So I had a lot of anxiety about this debt. It was the only way I could get my doctorate. So I just had to take it in the chin once I decided I was going to do that. And got out of grad school, owed $100,000 in student loan debt. I saw a friend of mine make $100,000 in 12 months trading stocks. And my thought was, what a fabulous way for me to get out of debt. I'll just trade stocks, make $100,000, and then be at zero. That was my goal. And so I did what any reasonable person would do, Isaac. I sold all my possessions and I put all my money in the stock market. And I had a fabulous 3 months and then the tech bubble burst. And I started to watch my money just drain away, realizing obviously that I had made a terrible mistake. And I was sort of curious with the question, you know, I had a ton of shame and embarrassment, of course, and left with the question, like, why would a reasonably intelligent person do something so stupid with his money? That was sort of the question I had, focused on myself, obviously. And so I did what any good new psychologists would do. I went into the literature and I started doing lit reviews to try to figure out, okay, what's the psychology of money? How can I figure out where I went wrong? And I came up empty. So basically the field of psychology to that point had utterly ignored the topic of money. And so I like to joke that within a matter of a couple of weeks, I became the world's leading expert in the psychology of money, mainly because psychologists seem to have avoided the whole topic. So that's really what got me interested. It was a very personal story. And it's led to a career of exploring this area.
And as you got into things with your own, after your own experiences, what were kind of the first things that you found right off the bat that were either the big issues or the big topics that came to the front?
Yeah. So for me, I got really curious around the psychology of wealth versus the psychology of, you know, poverty, for lack of a better word. So, and middle class. And so I started to do research on what, is there a psychology and a set of beliefs that are different for people who are either in that upper ultra wealthy class or raised in that sort of culture versus people who are raised like me, you know, below middle class. So I got really curious, like, what can we know about psychology to predict whether somebody's going to become wealthy or not? And so that really, that was the thrust of my early research, was on, is there a psychology of wealth? What is it? And because personally, like, I wanted to adopt that. I thought that would be great. I thought it'd be great to become wealthy. and so I was very curious, like, how do they look at the world differently? How do they look at themselves differently compared to middle class and below? So I got really fascinated with that. And one of the things we discovered is that they have very different beliefs around money. And so a lot of the studies I've done have been looking at what are the beliefs around money that predict higher income, higher net worth, good financial behaviors. And we did. We found four different patterns of beliefs, three of which are associated with basically having less money and more financial trouble. So I was actually pretty excited to find that there is a psychology related to wealth, because then I could train myself in it. And now obviously I'm helping train other people in that.
So from what you were saying, from these kind of the four money scripts, you've called them, is it something that you've seen where it's a lot of based on kind of where you grew up, what you grew up in, that type of thing?
Absolutely. So a lot of these beliefs are, and you can think about it, you know, your listeners can think about this, like what were you taught by your parents? Like, what did your mother teach you about money? What did your father teach you about money? What was it like for them growing up around money? And these money scripts, as we call them, get transmitted from grandparents to kids. And sometimes they go back for generations. And what's so interesting, we don't talk a lot about money. Typically it's not a polite topic of conversation. And so we don't really get to dive into the, you know, how are people looking at this differently and what are they doing differently than perhaps I'm doing or my family's doing. So yeah, they're fairly subconscious for most of us because we don't really think about it. But our research has shown a very clear pattern where these beliefs will directly be linked to whether or not you're financially successful.
What do you think, whether it's from your research or your own experiences, that makes money such a topic that nobody wants to talk about? It's not that common Sunday night dinner table conversation that goes on in a normal household.
Yep. And it's such an interesting question, Isaac. And I think there's so many layers to it. And I think fundamentally, at the very core, we're very worried about how other people are going to judge us. I think it's there's shame associated with it. We're very much checked into whether people are going to look at us in a negative way because we don't have money, or look at us as if we're a bad person because we do have money. And so we have a tendency to be extremely secretive around money until we know that somebody's at a similar socioeconomic level than we are, as we are, and then we kind of relax a little bit and we're actually able to be more forthcoming.
So in doing some research, reading some of the stuff you've put out there, you kind of talk about money disorders. Is that what you would kind of classify as one of those money disorders in a sense?
Well, there's a whole host of ways that we destroy ourselves financially. and it's sort of, what's so interesting to me is that we like to look at, just as a society in our sort of judgmental stance, we like to look at people who have money problems as being sort of outliers. Like, you know, what's wrong with these people? Well, the question really should be, what's wrong with the people that have somehow overcome this natural desire to spend as fast as you get it and consume as much as possible, which is kind of how we're wired as human beings. How can you overcome that to amass wealth and become wealthy? To me, that's the more curious question. I mean, the average American's in terrible financial shape. So if you're feeling bad about that, I mean, welcome to the club. I mean, I think it's more unusual that somebody is able to have a fabulous relationship with money and do all the right things. I think that's more unusual. So a huge part of it for me anyway is sort of shedding that shame that there's something wrong with you because you're struggling with money. You're the average American if you're struggling with money. Now, that's not to say you need to be staying there, but just get over that shame hump so you can move towards figuring out why you're doing what you're doing and self-correct.
What type of things have you found that, you know, are successful in helping people kind of get over that hump?
Yeah, I think part of it is what I'm trying to suggest right now, which is stop feeling so ashamed of yourself. I mean, I think that that shame becomes this emotional glue trap. And one of the reasons, Isaac, I talk about my personal story is because a lot of times when people start to hear from a financial educator, they immediately start to feel bad about themselves because they're feeling like, you know, I've messed up and I've done things that I shouldn't have done and I'm in financial trouble. And so part of what I wanted, the message I want to give out is like, yes, of course you are, you know, welcome to the club. So that's not really the issue. The issue is where do we go from here? So it's overcoming that barrier, I think is huge. And then it's extremely valuable for you to kind of dig around in your own family history. Like the financial trouble you're in right now, totally predictable based on your beliefs around money. And your beliefs around money came from where you grew up. So I think it really helps to examine that and to dig around a little bit and maybe even ask your parents or your other relatives like what it was like for them growing up around money. And very quickly, you're going to start hearing stories and beliefs. And that's going to make your relationship with money start to make a whole lot of sense.
So is this kind of a place where you feel like a growth in financial education is something that is needed to help people not only change the past and kind of quit themselves from repeating their family's success, but make that relationship a better one?
Yeah. So now obviously I'm a bit biased in about what I'm about to say, but I do believe that it's mostly psychology. I really do. Of course, I'm a psychologist, so take that with a grain of salt. But my argument, Isaac, is that, you know, the basics of personal finance are really not that complicated. I mean, financial education is useful, but very often it's not near enough because people already kind of know what they should be doing. Like the biggest problems in America aren't, you know, what's the difference between a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA? I mean, that's not what's tripping people up. The basics are extremely simple. You got to save for the future and don't spend more than you make. I mean, that's where most Americans are getting into trouble. So I think that more education to people who already kind of know what they should be doing is less effective than helping people really start to examine money from the viewpoint of their relationship with it and their own psychology around it.
As someone evaluates their own psychology or their own relationship with money, the psychology around it in their own kind of their own head or view, what are some, you know, either red flags or things that you mentioned, you know, not stressing about it or kind of changing the way you look at it? What are some things that you recommend people do right off the bat?
Well, I think it really helps to try to get a handle on what are your money scripts. Like, what are the beliefs you've been carrying around money? Like one of the categories we found that is extremely self-destructive is what we call money avoidance. So this is where we have a negative association with money. So we believe that money is somehow corrupting and rich people are greedy. There's this negative association with money. And what's so interesting about that is there are entire groups of people who have that belief. And what you'll see is that if somebody in that group starts to gain ground, so they're starting to become more wealthy, they get a bunch of crap from the rest of the people in the group. And it's almost like, you know, that metaphor of like crabs trying to get out of a barrel or a bucket, and the rest of them are dragging them down. And that's what happens. Because very often that negative belief, it's rooted in some sort of story and some sort of truth, but it's also not the absolute truth. There are certainly terrible human beings who happen to have money, terrible human beings who don't have money, and there are incredible human beings who have a lot of money who do great things in the world. So just as an example of a belief that our studies have shown directly links to self-destructive financial behaviors, lower income, lower net worth, that is really worth examining.
With that behavior in itself, what have you found has been kind of a key to overcoming your fear that having a lot isn't necessarily good?
So I think part of it is being aware of that belief is rattling around in your subconscious brain. You know, number one, it's sort of being aware of that, because logically you and I would say, well, of course I know that that's not how it is. But these are very often held at a very deep emotional level. And so just, I think, sort of recognizing that, and it's extremely difficult from a relational level and a personal level, a family level, a friendship level, to start changing your socioeconomic status. So I think understanding that is really, really important. once you start to become more financially successful than your closest friends or family members, just understand it's going to put a tremendous amount of stress on your relationships. People don't really think about this, but it's one of the reasons that helps explain why, and you've heard many of these stories, I'm sure, somebody wins the lottery, within a few years, all the money's gone. Or somebody gets a big sports contract, they blow it. Somebody gets a big music contract, they blow it. A lot of times what's happening is it's these relationships they have with people at their socioeconomic status that become threatened. And then people, you know, that's actually what sort of triggers the panic in the brain. We're all tribal sort of herd type animals when it comes to an emotional level. And so when we start to feel like we're distancing ourselves or we're getting further away from our tribe, it creates an emotional panic internally. And then you'll see people do these crazy things around money, which is basically an attempt to get back into that tribe where they feel safe.
So you kind of nailed what my next question was going to be there, but so you see a lot of the failure in kind of freeing yourself from these mindsets. Do you see it a lot coming from people who just kind of surround themselves with others who don't want to grow in their own mindset or aren't willing to kind of see someone else grow and develop?
Absolutely. And my best piece of advice is that if you want to climb that socioeconomic ladder, that you find somebody who's a rung or two above you. You know, like you try to call Tony Robbins right now, he's probably not going to have coffee with you. But if you want to find somebody a step or two ahead of you, these are often people that are already in your life. Perhaps it's somebody who's a position or two ahead of you in terms of your job, or if you wanted to become an author someday, for example, try to find somebody locally who's written a book. You got to find people who already believe it's possible. And then what you do is you sort of like a scientist, you take them out for coffee and you start picking their brain, you know, like, so what did you learn about money? And if you could go back, you know, in time and picture me as you 10 years ago, what advice would you give me? You really want to start to dive in, dig into how they're looking at money and how they're looking at life.
With kids coming right out of college, we've talked about these scripts and things like that, but what have you seen in your studies or just talking to people from the mindset or the psychology that's hammered into kids as they go to school and sometimes get told you have to have loans, you have to do this, you have to do that, when they come out of school with sometimes, as you mentioned yourself, $100,000 in debt?
Yeah. So what I think is so fascinating about this is we have cultural scripts too, and societal scripts. And one of the ones that we've had, and what's so interesting about all these beliefs is they're all 100% true in the right context, right? And then the context changes and then they become false and destructive. So for example, you know, one of the stories I found in my family history was my grandfather during the Great Depression lost all his money, went to the bank, all the money's gone. So just as an example of a belief, you can't trust banks with your money. Totally accurate belief in the moments before the Great Depression, right? And so 100% accurate. So this belief you have, it is rooted in a truth. Now, unfortunately for my grandfather and my whole family, actually, he never changed that belief. So the reality changed. So the banks, the federal government came in and started guaranteeing bank accounts, right? And so, but my grandfather never shifted his belief. And so part of financial health is being willing to sort of challenge some of those beliefs and shift with the changing times. And back to your example around college, it used to be that you go to college and you're set for life. So just getting into college and getting that degree didn't matter what it was in, but you're now in the upper echelons of society and, you know, the path is paved for you. You're gonna be able to make a lot more money. What's happened though is that college all of a sudden has become a business decision. And so you can't just go to the most expensive college and get, you know, an amorphous degree in nothing that's really specialized and then expect to go get a high paying six figure job. That doesn't happen anymore. So I think just as an example, if you're thinking about going to college, you have to approach it as a business decision. So think about what degree are you going to get? Do some research. How much are people making with that degree? And then you might even have to shop around to which college you want to go to and find a cheaper way.
When kids get out of school, you mentioned your debt, but what kind of psychological impact does kind of having that significant debt play on people?
Yeah. So there's been a lot of research on that topic, and carrying around a bunch of debt is kind of depressing. I mean, it's like that's, you know, and if you've had that experience, it can feel oppressive. You can feel hopeless. You can feel a sense of like helplessness. And so I think that's where it can help to actually sit down with somebody who's a professional and who can help you sort of understand what you're facing and help you develop strategies to address it. Because the problem with something that feels so overwhelming is that we have a natural tendency to want to avoid thinking about it, avoid dealing with it. And then of course the problem becomes bigger and more difficult over time.
And that in turn leads back to what you were talking about earlier with the money avoidance, I'm assuming.
Absolutely. Yeah. So like if you have this negative association with any aspect of your financial life, you're probably going to not pay attention to it, which is going to make things even worse.
All right. And on that note, we're going to start to wrap things up. Dr. Brad Klontz, really appreciate your time. One thing I did want to touch on, if people want to reach out, connect with you, how would they do that?
So I'm active on pretty much all social media, Dr. Brad Klontz, my YouTube channel. I try to take our research in financial psychology and make it sort of somewhat engaging. You can judge me on how I'm doing in that regard. and then, you know, I'm kind of big on TikTok right now, Isaac. It's kind of crazy. But just finding ways to sort of teach young kids around that proper sort of wealth mindset is sort of my passion right now.
Dr. Brad Klontz, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, if you enjoyed this episode as much as I did, make sure to click that subscribe button and leave a rating and let us know how we're doing, what we can do to help you, and what topics you want to hear. Additionally, if there's someone you think would be a great interview for the podcast, make sure to follow us on social media and let us know. We at Squire are here to help you, so don't be afraid to reach out no matter what question or issue you're running into. We look forward to hearing from you and talking to you on social media.